In what ways does the current system of policing and law enforcement reflect America's legacy of slavery? Why would the collapse of modern capitalism be an indispensable prerequisite in the eradication of racism? How does media and popular culture perpetuate the bondage of blacks within America? What is Canada's record on racial intolerance toward black people, and how does that legacy express itself within Canadian society today? Is there renewed hope for Mumia Abu-Jamal, one of the most famous victims of racism within America's justice system? On this week's Global Research NewsHour radio program, on the occasion of Black History Month, we examine some of the legacy of white supremacy as it has flourished within the North American context. Our guests include editor of Pan-African Newswire, Abayomi Azikiwe, professor, author, poet, and historian, Afua Cooper, and international concerned family and friends of Mumia Abu-Jamal campaigner, Suzanne Ross. On this week's program, Black History Month Special, The Myths and Realities of Liberation Within the United States and Canada. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of February 23rd, 2018. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on occupied Anishinaabe territory on the homeland of the Métis Nation. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today, from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. On the heels of Iowa and Ohio, Wyoming has become the third state to introduce a bill criminalizing the type of activities undertaken by past oil and gas pipeline protesters. One of the Wyoming bill's co-sponsors even says it was inspired by the protests led by the Standing Rock Sioux tribe against the Dakota Access Pipeline, and a sheriff involved in policing those protests testified in support of the bill at a recent hearing. Wyoming's bill is essentially a copy-paste version of template legislation produced by the conservative, corporate-funded American Legislative Exchange Council, or ALEC. At the organization's December meeting, ALEC members voted on the model bill, the Critical Infrastructure Protection Act, which afterward was introduced in both Iowa and Ohio. Like the ALEC version, Wyoming's Senate File 74 makes, quote, impeding critical infrastructure a felony, punishable by imprisonment for not more than 10 years, a fine of not more than $100,000, or both, unquote. That comes from the article, Cracking Down on Pipeline Protests, Wyoming Now Third State to Propose ALEC Bill, by Steve Horn, posted February 22nd, originally appearing at DSmog blog. If they're not Fox News fans, MSNBC, CNN, and the rest of the liberal extremist media have probably already convinced them that the Russian government is responsible, as has resistance royalty, Bernie Sanders, Harvard Law Professor Lawrence Tribe, and California Congressional Reps Adam Schiff, Ted Lieu, and Jackie Speier, just to name a few. I mentioned the Californian reps because I live here, where they make the most noise when they're not in Washington, although many Americans outside the Golden State now recognize the glazed eyes and fundamentalist countenance of Adam Schiff, who represents West Hollywood to the eastern border of Pasadena and Echo Park to the Angeles National Forest. Jimmy Dore and his wife, Steph Zamorano, live in Pasadena, and Steph has suggested suing Schiff for neglecting his constituents to lead the former communist crusade on the national stage. On Meet the Press, Bernie Sanders said that everybody knows the Republicans are trying to sabotage the 2018 midterms. Seemed like he actually made a little slip on the air there. He probably meant the Russians, although he said the Republicans because he went on to further accuse the Russians. That comes from the article, Anti-Trump, Anti-Russian Fundamentalism, The Reckless Resistance by Anne Garrison, posted February 22nd. The book primarily investigates the official reports about Operation Cast Lead from 2008 to 2009, the Mavi Marmara from 2010, and Operation Protective Edge from 2014. Finkelstein attributes these assaults in part to Israel's intention to prove its deterrence capacity after its defeat by Hezbollah in 2006. A pattern emerges of Israel's surreptitious provocations that conceal its own aggression, use of disproportionate military force and targeting of civilians, specious legality, and lies that exonerate Israel and permit ever-increasing brutality. The Dahiya doctrine refers to Israel's military strategy of acting immediately, decisively, and with disproportionate force. Dahiya is a suburb of Beirut that was flattened by Israel in the 2006 war. That comes from the article, Gaza, Who or What Has a Right to Exist? By Judith Deutsch, posted February 22nd, originally appearing at The Bullet. The Olympics, as well as the bilateral negotiations, provide an opportunity to eventually repeal the Combined Forces Command. What is needed is a mass movement supportive of a government decision to unilaterally withdraw all ROK forces from the Combined Forces Command, namely a unilateral repeal of the CFC, which extends to 2025, signed in 2014 on the orders of Washington by President Park Geun-hye, who was subsequently impeached. The objective is to reinstate President Moon as commander-in-chief of ROK forces as a means to achieving peace. This means that if the U.S. still wants to attack the DPRK, it will not be able to rely on ROK forces, and historically the U.S. has always relied on its allies to do the dirty work. I think that the U.S. will do its utmost to sabotage the North-South dialogue while maintaining the Combined Forces Command intact. That comes from the text of Michelle Chalcedovsky's February 21st presentation to the Republic of Korea National Assembly under the headline, North Korea and the Dangers of Nuclear War, the Demilitarization of the Korean Peninsula Towards a Peace Agreement, posted February 22nd. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. While admitting that America has a long way to go in restoring equality and justice for its population of African descent, many are accustomed to thinking of the horrors of America's racist past as being mostly behind them. In 2018, America's legacy of white supremacy continues to pronounce itself through a number of systemic factors within the economic and so-called justice system. Joining us to discuss some of these factors is past guest Abayomi Azikiwe. He is editor of Pan-African Newswire and a frequent contributor to Global Research. Thank you for joining us, Abayomi.
Thank you for the invitation again.
Now, you've written and spoke of late about African Americans remaining the targets of a system of institutional racism and super exploitation. Most of us aren't used to thinking of the current system of policing and mass incarceration of black people as slavery by other means. Was this costume change a deliberate choice, or was it a consequence of unaddressed issues within American society?
I believe it is both. Of course, after the Civil War, between 1861 and 1865, there was an attempt by the United States Congress that was also generated by the necessity of reforming the Southern economic system of slavery that was tied to a system of capitalism that helped actually spawn the growth of monopoly capitalism. However, at the same time, the contradictions between the agriculturally based exploitative system and the more industrially oriented system reached a point of confrontation. after 1860. However, with the abandonment of the South by the federal government after 1876, there was, of course, an effort by the white slaveocracy to reimpose a system of super exploitation in the southern part of the United States primarily. And what they did was the passage of a series of laws commonly known as the Black Codes. Then there was a number of federal court decisions and Supreme Court decisions, for example, the Slaughterhouse case of 1873. Later, there was the Plessy versus Ferguson case of 1896. Both of these Supreme Court decisions actually nullified the equal protection clauses of the 14th Amendment, the due process clause of the 14th Amendment. And then, of course, there was an effort to reimpose slave labor. This was done as well through the criminal justice system. There was the slavery by any other name, which was a title of a book and a documentary film that was done by Douglas Blackman. And, of course, there was a film done, a documentary film done by the public broadcasting system in the United States, which it illustrates very clearly that vagrancy laws and other forms of trumped-up charges were used to frame African-Americans, to sentence them to long terms in prison, and then to use their labor while they were in prison to build agricultural developments, to expand industrialism in the South. And, of course, this was done as well through a method of racial profiling, where African Americans became targets of this. Now, this could easily be upheld legally as the Southern ruling class rationalized through the 13th Amendment. We think of the 13th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution that was passed in 1865 as an amendment that outlawed and said that slavery was unconstitutional. Nonetheless, in the first section of the 13th Amendment, it says that involuntary servitude is illegal, although it can be carried out when people are serving prison sentences for crimes that they have been convicted of. So they really had a legal rationale for carrying on this system of super exploitation. So we had a nullification of the 14th Amendment, which was passed in 1868, and then there was the 13th Amendment, which was passed in 1865. And, of course, these two constitutional amendments were basically ignored all the way up until the 1950s and 1960s in the United States.
Another development through history is this what's become the National Rifle Association, and this insistence on protecting firearms and people protecting themselves from a violent state or whatever. But it seems to me that just looking at the way Black Americans have been historically treated, it seems like if there's one group of people that would be most deserving of that consideration of arming themselves to protect themselves from a violent state, it would be Blacks. So if the NRA, I typically only seem to see white faces within the NRA, but could you maybe explain if the NRA, if there's like a racial or racist component to that whole entity?
I believe it is. I strongly believe that the Trump administration, the National Rifle Association, the Conservative Political Action Committee, CPAC, who was holding its national conference earlier this week, they have a conception of the right to bear arms, which, in my opinion, harks back to the founding of the Ku Klux Klan in 1866, the notion that white men in particular have some inherent right to rule the institutions and the economic means of production inside the United States. this is all it means. And that's why the National Rifle Association is dominated by a white male conservative. This phenomena, of course, is intersecting with the widespread mass shootings that are taking place in the United States. Even though the U.S. prides itself as being a democracy, as being a stable country politically and socially, the situation on the ground is actually just the opposite. We've seen so many mass shootings over the last year, particularly over the last several months. What happened in Las Vegas, where one man from a casino hotel had a tremendous arsenal, which he utilized to open fire on people at a country and western concert, killing dozens and wounding several hundred people. We also saw a former U.S. military soldier go into a small church in Texas and massacre dozens of people as well and injuring many more. Of course, the incident that took place in South Florida just a week ago is another case in point. Yet, we have the National Rifle Association, CPAC, and the Trump administration arguing against any form of gun control. And I think they are operating, particularly the NRA, as a somewhat lobby for the gun manufacturers here in the United States. That's one of the major industries in the U.S., and that is the manufacturer of firearms. Now, the question about firearms is very interesting because when groups like the Black Panther Party, for example, in the Republic of New Africa in the 1960s armed themselves against racist violence and violence by the state, most of the conservatives in the United States were against it. They sided with law enforcement. They sided with the FBI and the federal government, the Johnson administration, the Nixon administration, against these African-American youth who found it necessary to take up arms against state repression and racist violence. So it's a contradiction in that regard. On the one hand, they say that the Second Amendment should be upheld, but when oppressed people utilize that same constitutional law, whether it's the Second Amendment, whether it's the 13th Amendment or the 14th Amendment or the 15th Amendment, then, of course, it cannot be applied. So this is clearly a power struggle that's taking place inside the United States between an ever-shrinking white majority and a expanding African-American, Latino, Middle Eastern, indigenous expanding minority. And, of course, the demographics of the situation is quite striking, and I think Trump exemplifies that when he often speaks about illegal immigration, getting rid of undocumented workers, and other issues related to people who are not of European descent, who are residents and citizens of the United States.
You know, typically when we hear people like, you know, liberals trying to, you know, to end racism, I think it's often depicted as an artifact of ignorance. And I think that's a mistake because it underestimates the level of sophistication that goes into perpetuating the systemic racism, and that there are certain economic benefits to a portion of the population. Not just, you know, people, you know, whites who feel that they're not able to get their jobs or whatever. I'm wondering if you could maybe, you know, expand a little bit on this idea of certain elite interests and how they profit literally from the perpetuation of racism.
Yes, this is a key component to the ruling apparatus in the United States. It has been since the conclusion of the Civil War. A lot of the programs and policies that were advocated by African-American political officials during the Reconstruction period, during the post-Civil War, from the 1860s through the 1870s, and even on a state and local level through the 1880s and 1890s, these policies actually benefited whites as well. They benefited working people and poor people in general. but it became necessary in order to fortify a white supremacist ruling capitalist exploitative system, was to divide poor white, working class white, from poor black and working class blacks on a racial basis. And that still exists today. We see how Trump, during the 2016 campaign, appealed to the white working class by saying that he was going to reopen the coal mines, he was going to reopen factories, he was going to stop jobs from being outsourced to Mexico and to China and other areas where countries are dominated by non-Europeans. This was his appeal to broad sections of the white population. He won over a significant number of them in order to secure an electoral college victory in 2016, even though he lost the popular vote. So he's continuing to do this. If you listen to his speech that was done on February 23rd at the CPAC conference, he's making the same appeal, saying that if the Democrats take over the Congress during the midterm elections, which is scheduled to take place later on this year, that you'll have socialism, you'll have a denial of your Second Amendment rights, which is the right to bear arms for white people. He also goes on to say that the Democrats will repeal the tax cut in which he imposed. Now, this tax cut is really a form of austerity being launched against the majority of people inside the United States, not only the poor and the working class, but also the middle class as well. So he wants to, in effect, continue this division between black people and white people, the masses of black people and white people inside the United States, because it benefits his interests, it benefits the interests of Wall Street. And we've seen the volatility on Wall Street, the escalation of the Dow Jones Industrial Average, the NASDAQ, and so forth. Yet at the same time, when there's an announcement about a potential rise in interest rates or a rise in income, of course, the stock market goes down. And he, of course, in his tax bill that was ratified by the Republican-dominated Senate and House, reducing the corporate tax rate from 35% to 21%, of course, in doing this, he creates a situation where the wealthiest corporations and individuals in U.S. society and throughout the world, in fact, feel confident about their future, that they will experience huge profits and huge privileges at the expense of working class people and poor people inside the United States.
You've commented on this show before, and a little bit in this show, about how the racist project and the project of capitalism are somehow linked, that you can't really get rid of racism without ultimately subverting capitalism. Could you maybe suggest what a joint anti-racist, anti-capitalist project would look like?
Yes, it would have to, of course, deal with the super exploitation of African Americans, of people of Latin American descent inside the United States. I would have to support a drastic increase in the minimum wage. I would have to require a guaranteed annual income, national health insurance, which we do not have in the United States, even though just right across the border in Canada, there is national health insurance. Somehow, the United States feels, the rulers of the United States feels, that it would destroy the healthcare system to guarantee everyone who is a citizen and resident of the United States full health coverage benefit. It would guarantee full employment. Now, these are some of the same demands that Dr. Martin Luther King was advancing 50 years ago at the time of his assassination. He was attempting to organize a poor people's campaign when he stopped off in Memphis, Tennessee to support a African-American sanitation worker strike demanding recognition and a living wage. He was assassinated on April 4th of 1968. However, he wanted these same demands that still remain with us today, as I mentioned earlier, the need for full employment, a guaranteed annual income, national health insurance, the rebuilding of the central cities in regard to decent housing, and today, of course, we have a greater consciousness about environmental justice, to fight against ecological degradation, which is widespread throughout the urban areas inside the United States. So, yes, Dr. King, 50 years ago, drew the link between imperialist war that was taking place in Vietnam. He also said it was necessary to end poverty as well as racism. So these issues are still with us today, some 5 decades later.
I was wondering if you could also, because you're alluding to Martin Luther King, and I know that his image has been somewhat sanitized over the years. I mean, we don't, in the retrospectives, we don't hear so much about that more radical King, if you will. And of course, there are other images of black people in the media about being violent or ignorant or what have you. I was wondering if you could possibly comment on the role that you see media playing currently in continuing to foster those racial divisions, even in spite of what might be considered more uplifting movies like the current Black Panther movie.
There's a situation where for decades the corporate media has tried to sanitize the image of Dr. Martin Luther King, the civil rights movement, and the African-American movement in general. Dr. King was killed with the complicity of the federal government. The FBI had tens of thousands of files on him and the civil rights movement during the 1960s. And J. Edgar Hoover was by no means a supporter of civil rights, equal justice, and self-determination for the African-American people. Today, we have a similar situation. 50 years ago, there was the counterintelligence program, Black Nationalist Hate Group project. There was the Key Black Extremist Index, which targeted key African-American activists for destabilization and discrediting. Today, the FBI just last year issued a Black Identity Extremist Index saying that somehow people who are out demonstrating against racism are a threat to law enforcement and the status quo. So this is a continual process, and of course this is something that people need to be conscious of inside this country, and as well as internationally. The United States tries to pride itself as being a paragon for civil rights and human rights, when in fact today African Americans, Latinos, Middle Eastern communities, indigenous communities are still subjected to national oppression and institutionalized racism.
Abayomi Ezekiwe, I wish we had more time, but I think we'll have to let you go. But I want to thank you very much for sharing these important insights with us, especially during this important month.
Thank you so much, and keep up the good work.
Okay, will do. We've been joined by Abayomi Ezekiwe. He is the editor of Pan-African Newswire and a frequent contributor to Global Research.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca.
Jamaican-born Dr. Afua Cooper is Associate Professor at Dalhousie University in Halifax, Nova Scotia, Canada. She holds the James Robinson Johnston Chair in Black Canadian Studies and is celebrated as an award-winning poet, author, historian, curator, performer, cultural worker, and recording artist. Afua holds a PhD in history with specialties in slavery, abolition, and women's studies, and is one of Canada's premier experts and chroniclers of the country's black past. She joins us now by phone. Welcome, Professor Cooper.
Thank you.
It strikes me that Canadians tend to sanitize their own history of racism and hold up their country as some sort of benevolent model of virtue in the world. I mean, the country is only recently, it seems, coming to terms with its injustices towards Indigenous peoples. with regard to residential schools, dislocation and such. With regard to the history of blacks on the North American continent, Canadians typically forget its own history of slavery, focusing instead on Canada as the promised land in the era of the Underground Railroad. How critical was the slave trade to the Canadian economy and Canadian society in the 18th century?
How critical was it?
Yeah, for the economy and society.
Thank you. Well, I would answer the question by saying that under both the colonial, both the French and the English colonial regimes, and the enslavement of Africans was an established institution. So during the French period, the first, we would say Canada's first black slave, Olivier Lejeune, arrived here in 1628. By the time the 17th century matured, you find blacks coming from all over the world to what we could call Quebec, being held in the status of the enslaved. When Canada was conquered by Britain in 1760, in fact, the enslavement of Africans intensified, as by then Britain was the largest slave trading empire on the planet. So all throughout our older colonies, the five older colonies, you know, from the planter period, the planters coming from New England to Maritimes Canada, even among the Acadians before they were banned from Canada or expelled from Nova Scotia and New Brunswick, the Acadians also held slaves. And certainly during the Loyalist dispensation, we hear about the free black loyalists, but there at least 1,500 enslaved black loyalists came up to Canada. All throughout, we have this history of slavery. Now that we know that on the Eastern Canadian Front, merchants from Halifax and other places on the East were involved in the West India trade. This was before the abolition of British slavery in 1833. And merchants from Eastern Canada helped to support slavery's infrastructure in the Caribbean by sending down the pickled meats, the salted cod, the flour, the timber, the horses, and so on to support slavery in the Caribbean. And in reverse, the slave planters, the slave owners of the Caribbean, sent up the rum and the sugar and the molasses that would grace the table of everyone in the five older colonies from the governor right down to the humblest yeoman farmer. People were consuming slave-grown products. So it's not only just within Canada where you have homegrown slavery, but Canadian provinces were also involved in the Atlantic trade from the Caribbean. That was the British Caribbean, French Caribbean, or Spanish Caribbean. And that history has been covered up.
Mm. Now, slavery did not come to an end in Canada all in one day, and as I understand it, the government's compensation of slave owners was more generous than that of the slaves themselves. What was the historical fallout of that flawed process?
Yes, quite so. I mean, there were sort of different abolitions within the five older colonies. And for the listeners, when I'm talking about the five older colonies, I'm talking about today what we call Nova Scotia, New Brunswick, Prince Edward Island, Ontario, and Quebec. These are kind of the originary spaces of the colonies that eventually became the core of the Canadian nation state, the Canadian settler state. So finally, in 1833, the British Parliament passed an act to abolish the enslavement of Africans within the British colonies. And within Canada, what we call Canada, as I just explained, several enslaved people got their freedom. But when we are looking at the slavery's compensation, the British government compensated slave owners. And when we're looking at who received what, it's interesting. Because a British historian by the name of Nicholas Draper has written this book about compensation. And we see that business people in Canada, including the family of the second wife of Sir John A. Macdonald, received compensation. The wife of Sir John A. Macdonald, his second wife, came from a Jamaican landed class, and her family owned 75 slaves. And so when slavery was abolished, her family got several thousand pounds for the loss of their property. And Michael, the enslaved people who had labored for over 250 years for free, had their life, their labor, and their children stolen, did not receive 1 cent from the British government. So, you know, Sir John Jay family's one. We have Mather Bales Allman, who was a governor of Dalhousie University and also of King's College in Halifax. He received compensation money from two slave plantations in Jamaica. It's as we do this work, we're uncovering the links, the colonial links between the different colonies and between the ruling class in each colony, the ruling class in Nova Scotia, the ruling class in Quebec, with the ruling classes. These are the slaveocracy, the slave owners in Jamaica and Antigua and so forth.
I know that when I first interviewed you, I first had a chance to hear you speak. You'd just written the book, The Hanging of Angelique, the story of a Portuguese-born woman, who's a slave to a widow in old Montreal. She was subjected to what resembles, to my mind anyway, a witch trial, tortured and hanged on the charge of burning down her mistress's house and subsequently 45 other buildings, which she denied until broken under torture. Can you help us understand the context of this trial and why authorities went to such extreme and inhumane lengths to see her prosecuted?
Yes. So we're still, with that trial, we're still in the French period. And the French system of justice was inquisitorial, meaning you're guilty until proven innocent. And so they come at you. You have to prove your innocence. And you have to prove your innocence through your words. You have to have, like, great verbal skills. So the judges were there. They said they accused Angelique of burning down her mistress's house, which led to a big fire in what we now called Old Montreal. She denied it. So eventually she was tortured. She broke under torture. She confessed to setting the fire. And her sentence was that she was going to be burnt alive. They did reduce or modify the sentence to hanging. So they were going to hang her first and then burn her body, which is what they did. So it's the context of French justice, which is inquisitorial. And they come up with a guilty verdict, even if you're innocent. The fact that Angelique was an enslaved woman meant that she was a social outcast. She had no support from anyone. She was a victim. She had no family, no one. She was literally out there alone in the world. She was not a free woman. She was not a white woman. Because we know, you know, murder is also a capital offense, meaning punishable by death. And around the time now, a white woman had killed her husband, but she was exiled from the colony. They didn't hang her. She was exiled. But, you know, Angelique's status certainly played a role in how she was treated and the gruesome and the awful sentence that she that was carried out upon her body.
Now, moving up to the early 20th century, I know that black people from the American South answered the call, along with Europeans, to settle the prairies as farmers and homesteaders. But this wave of immigration was very brief. Could you talk about some of the resistance they encountered from their neighbors and from Canadian authorities?
Absolutely. So one may ask, well, okay, that was slavery. That was then. What does that have to do with us now? And one of the things I always like to talk about is the legacies of slavery. The legacies, the aftermath, the afterlife. So when these African-American farmers answered the call, as you rightly put it, the Canadian government was settling the prairies, and these African-American farmers, they were farmers, they knew how to do prairie farming, they were coming from Oklahoma, Nebraska, and, you know, all those Kansas, all those cold places. They were Christians, they spoke English, they had money. So, in theory, they were perfect settlers, except the Canadian government did not want blacks. As we confederated in 1867, the country was conceptualized as a white man's country. You look at the immigration documents. They said this country is for the sons of the white race, right? So they saw the American blacks through the lens of slavery. All across the prairies in your province, Manitoba, there was this hysteria that if black people, especially black men, came up, they're going to ravish white women. So you have this intersection of race, gender, sexuality, and it was sort of all cast on the body of the black man as this rapist, right? So there was this hysteria against these, you know, God-fearing, decent black people coming from America. They were not wanted because Canada was conceptualized as a white space. And so the Dominion government or the federal government passed an order in council to ban black migration. So many petitions, Edmonton Board of Trade, the Winnipeg Board of Trade, all these various business organizations petitioned the federal government to stop black migration. And under Laurier, Prime Minister Laurier, the Liberal government, and later Borden, that's exactly what happened. So it was very brief. These African and Americans were turned away at the border. They even sent recruiting agents down to Texas and Oklahoma to tell the people not to come. They said, Canada is so cold, you won't withstand it. Everything freezes in the ground. You will not be able to survive in Canada. You know, meanwhile, these people are living in Kansas. So that was the kind of racism that the federal government carried out towards the black community.
Yeah, you're talking about this legacy of slavery, and today no politician in Canada would express outright racism toward black people, but that does not necessarily mean systemic barriers have gone away. Could you address the systemic and institutional barriers and trends that you see enduring to this day?
I want to look at maybe two examples. And the first one is who is wanted in Canada, even up until this day, who is wanted? And it's certainly not the black body. Here's why. There are only 4 immigration offices that issue resident visas to Africans on the continent of Africa. The continent of Africa is huge, as you know. Over 1 billion people. Canada only has 4 visa offices on the entire continent. So if you are in Sierra Leone and someone sponsors you or you're trying to get a visa, you have to go to Senegal or Ghana for that, because in those 2 places there are immigration offices, which means you have to buy a plane ticket or travel by road. You have to find money for a hotel. You have to find money for food. And heaven forbid if you have children and, you know, and a spouse, so, you know, which brings up the cost. When you look at, there are 16 immigration offices, if you want to compare that to another place, in Hong Kong, 16. So it's clear that Canada still does not want black people as immigrants coming in. The focus is now on certain Asian countries. I think they have given up on Europe because Europeans just don't migrate. There's no need for them to migrate anymore. So that's one example. The second example is when you look at some of the main cities in Canada, the larger cities, I should say, or let me put another way, the cities where you have big black populations like Toronto, Halifax, Montreal, Hamilton, and so on. You find blacks are incarcerated at a higher rate. Higher rates in arrest statistics. Black children, at least 40% in my city of Halifax, where I live. Toronto, certainly, dropping out of school. You see these systemic forms of racial discrimination against the black community. Toronto only has 8% black people. 42% of the children in foster care are African-Canadian children. So there's something going on, and this has been going on for years. We have report after report, the Stephen Lewis report in 1992, several after that, so many that talk about the same thing, the systemic barriers, the structural barriers. And what we see is governments dragging their legs in addressing some of these issues. And so from the time of slavery to present time, we have this extreme discrimination against black people in this country. At the end of January 28th this year, we saw Prime Minister Justin Trudeau talking about the United Nations Decade for the People of African Descent and talking about discrimination against black people in Canada. I mean, I looked at him and he said it. And he said, we have to do better. But you're looking at some of these forms of discrimination. What I'm sure you, this can resonate with you, Michael, as a journalist. But after the Prime Minister gave his talk about the decade and how discrimination against black people in Canada must end, when the journalists asked him questions, they did not ask him one question about the press conference he gave. They asked about sexual harassment in the parliament, nothing about what he called the press conference for. It was simply astounding.
Yes.
Simply astounding. So the media, as if to say, well, Justin, you're talking about discrimination of blacks. We're not interested in that. And we're going to show you we're not interested. We won't ask you any question on that.
Which brings up.
I think the Prime Minister, after the third irrelevant question, should have said, look, guys, I made this press conference. I've issued this press release. What is your response to it? But nothing.
Afua Cooper, I thank you for joining me during Black History Month. I wish we had more time, but thanks for giving our listeners a taste of the myths and realities of the Black experience in Canada. All the best.
Thank you. The pleasure was mine, Michael.
We've been joined by award-winning poet, author, historian, and recording artist, Dalhousie University professor Afua Cooper. Before we close this episode of the show, we wanted to bring you an update in the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal, widely seen as a political prisoner and a symptom of the racism inherent within America's so-called justice system. Initially arrested in 1981 and placed on death row in the killing of a Philadelphia police officer, Mumia was subjected to significant irregularities in his case. Thanks in large part to an international campaign, Mumia was successfully removed from death row but now is serving a life sentence. There has been a recent call to action on Mumia's behalf. Suzanne Ross, a representative of the International Concerned Family and Friends of Mumia Abu-Jamal, joined us recently to share the details.
We just put out a call on this, you know, beginning of December around the world, asking people to endorse two demands. One is the demand that all the records, police and district attorney records, relevant to Mumia's case, but specifically to the conflict of interest involved in one individual who happened to have been involved in the district attorney's office and played a role in prosecution of the case back in the early 80s, and then, lo and behold, became a Supreme Court justice of the Pennsylvania Supreme Court and got to rule on his own ruling. In other words, he got to decide whether Mumia's appeal for all the decisions that were made in the original prosecution of his case that found him guilty and warranting a death sentence, this case then came up before the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, and a key person that was involved in the prosecution now got to be the person, one of the people, reviewing the case.
That would be Ronald Castile.
And that was Ronald Castile. Ronald Castile is one of the really, really critical, horrible individuals. Politically, I don't know him, of course. Politically horrible, pro-death penalty, pro-mass incarceration, pro-unlimited rights to police. And he got to almost single-handedly play a role in the original prosecution of Mumia in the lower court of Pennsylvania, in the Philadelphia court, the Court of Common Pleas, it's called. He got to play a key role in that, then got to play a key role in the state Supreme Court, and, of course, was out to kill Mumia. He he campaigned against Mumia. He was, by the way, very close to the Fraternal Order of Police. He was named Man of the Year by the Fraternal Order of Police, which is, for those who might think it's a union, it's not a union. It's basically a criminal body of policemen who've hung together to, and many of them have been convicted over time of criminality. Many of these policemen have been on numerous cases. In fact, all the policemen who were at the scene of the so-called crime where Mumia was nearly beaten, nearly killed by the police, and where a policeman was killed in that scene. But at that scene, the police officer in charge of the whole operation, the policemen there, were all indicted later and convicted for some kind of corruption, for different kinds of corruption, perhaps. So this is the operation that convicted Mumia, that locked him up, that sentenced to death, that tried to kill him twice through legal means, once through medical malpractice, and now there's a chance that this case could be opened up. That's what this coming March 27th in the Court of Common Pleas in Philadelphia is going to review the issue of the... Well, first we have to force the district attorney's office to turn over the records that the police and the district attorney's office have that show the relationship between Ronald Castile and Mumia's conviction. In other words, they're saying now that Ronald Castile played a very minor role in this whole case. Well, we know that's absurd. That's absurd. A man who believes in the death penalty, a man who supports the police unequivocally, who is determined to continue the death penalty, and who has been actively involved in fighting for the execution of so many of the prisoners who've come up before him. You mean this guy does not care and sat back quietly and silently while the most famous political prisoner in the country, one of the most famous political prisoners in the world, who was sentenced to death when that case was before him, he sat back quietly? Absurd. Right? We know that's absurd. And so we have to get these. We are sure that the conspiracy to kill Mumia, to execute him, and now he's off death row, of course, but has been sentenced to life with prison without any opportunity for parole. And we know that that kind of life in prison without any opportunity for parole is really a slow death penalty.
Mm. Could you talk about what he's experiencing now? He does have some health problems, as I understand it.
Yes, he does. So let me just go back, because I jumped around a little. So let me just go back and review one thing, and then I'll tell you about his health situation, which is that I was saying that back in early December, we put out a call for people to endorse the demand, support the demand for, one, releasing all these records that I'm talking about that could lead to Mumia's ultimate freedom, and two, that Mumia be released now because he's innocent, because he's sick, because they have nearly killed him, because they have denied him all kinds of due process, et cetera, et cetera. So this is the campaign. With that, those two demands, we have had people sign that, people have endorsed that call from all over the world. 15 members of the Danish Parliament. 15 members of the Danish Parliament signed that. People like, of course, Cornel West, Angela Davis, you know, Danny Glover, all those kinds of people. Unions, major unions in the United States, a major union in Japan, in Australia, in France. The response has been mind-blowing. So when I say Mumia's case is so important to people and that 36 years later people are still supporting him, I'm saying that off this response that I happen to coordinate this signing this petition, this letter, it's called an international letter, that the response was way beyond what we expected. 15 members of the Danish parliament, we hadn't heard or talked with them for years. And still people remember Mumia and say, this case is very, very important to us. So now let me answer your question about his health, okay?
Sure.
All right. So Mumia was very sick, nearly died from medical malpractice a little more than 2 years ago, and then was diagnosed by a doctor that we brought in who could only see Mumia in the waiting room. He was not given medical privileges, but he came, examined Mumia's skin, examined, looked at his symptoms, looked at the blood records and all that, and said Mumia had hepatitis C and that he was suffering from all the side effects and so on of hepatitis C. And we began a campaign to get Mumia the cure for hepatitis C, which is now available. There's a drug that really cures people and seems to have little of no or no side effects. So after a two-year battle where the Department of Corrections in Pennsylvania refused to give him this drug, we finally forced them through the courts. And through us testifying in court, I myself testified as a friend, others testified, this doctor who consulted, he was the key witness really, saying he is going to die of this illness if he's not treated. He needs this drug. And the judge ordered the Department of Corrections to immediately grant that drug. And lo and behold, he got it. And lo and behold, he got cured of hepatitis C. Unfortunately, the vestige of having had hepatitis C for as long as he had, probably about more than 20 years, I think, because he had gotten when he was originally nearly killed and he had to have blood transfusions in the hospital. In other words, the system gave him hepatitis C with the blood transfusion, which he no doubt needed, but they didn't even check on the blood, clear it adequately, and even follow up on the possibility that he had hepatitis C. At any rate, he has now been left with cirrhosis of the liver. It's not super advanced. We're not sure whether that's what's accounting for his horrible itching, painful, painful itching throughout across his body, his whole body. And the medications they were giving him were not adequate. We've asked for him to be transferred to a hospital. They haven't done that. And they're giving him a new drug now, which we'll have to see if it works. It takes 2 or 3 months for that drug to kick in. In the meantime, they give him various palliative things, which are helping a little, but he's still suffering a lot. So that is Mumia's current health condition. So we're saying, on top of his innocence, you know, they owe him the release because they're not treating him. They got him sick. They nearly killed him. And enough is enough. Release Mumia now.
Mumia's next court hearing is March 27th. The campaign to free Mumia Abu-Jamal is issuing a call for international demonstrations, protests, and events coinciding with that date, and to come to the courthouse on that date to show their support. For more details, please visit www.freemumia.com. You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. We are now also broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com.